Why Corruption Threatens Global Security. For a long time, Egypt's military has been a state within a state, with its banking and business activities making up 25 to 40% of the country's economy. It is the largest landowner in the world and the ultimate Egyptian president's maker and the breaker. In 2011, a widespread revolt at the height of the Arab Spring forced the resignation of President Hosni Mubarak, who had run the country for 30 years. The military had something to do with that resignation, as he turned over power to the Supreme Armed Forces Council of Egypt. But when a fledgling democracy brought its formidable foe, the Muslim Brotherhood, to power with Mohamed Morsi's victory, it was too much for the generals. It has made Morsi make his own mistakes, including repressing nonviolent demonstrators. So there was no opposition when his defense minister, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, led a military coup against Morsi in 2012. Since then, Sisi and the Egyptian army have directly run the country, making the state and the deep state the same. Trump and the deep state. From his earliest days in the White House, Donald Trump and his officials have invaded on what the president has frequently branded as the deep state. However, what he means by the word is something different from its more conventional use. Rather than referring to a secret or parallel government structure that exists outside of official channels, for Trump, the deep state is the government, or at least those parts of it that frustrate him in some way. For example, when the judiciary throws up barriers to the government by decree, that is the deep state at work for him. Would you like to declare a complete and total shutdown of Muslims entering the United States, but the courts put a stop on your executive order? Blame the deep state condition. Have unnamed government officials told the press that Michael Flynn, your national security advisor, was lying about his communications with Russian officials? Blame the leaks on the deep state. White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer understood as early as March 2017 that the administration fully believed in the presence of a deep state. This shadow organization had penetrated many of the federal government's offices and activities. A reporter asked him, "Does the government believe there's such a thing as a deep state involved in undermining the president?" Spicer replied, "I think that when you have 8 years with one party in office, there's no doubt that there are people who remain in government affiliated with, entered, and continue to support the previous administration's plan. So I don't think it should come as a surprise that there are people who burst into government during the last 8 years with the administration and may have believed in it." In other words, the deep state for the Trump administration and its allies is any aspect of the government apparatus itself that is not doing their bidding. HuffPost has put together a handy list of some of Trump's tweets referencing the deep state. He criticized unidentified deep state officials in November 2017 for failing to continue investigating Hillary Clinton's emails, calling those officials rigged and corrupt. That same month, he tweeted that the FBI and the Department of Justice had withheld details on Donald Trump's associate surveillance. That was, he claimed, big stuff, deep state, and he begged someone to show these details now. In January 2018, Hillary Clinton's former assistant, Huma Abedin, was accused of putting classified passwords in possession of foreign agents. Did this mean, he asked, that the Deep State Justice Department would eventually act. He added that if it were to act eventually, it should be all the same on Comey and others. In May 2018, he accused the criminal deep state of going after phony collusion with Russia, a hoax made up, and getting swept up in a big spy scandal that this country could never have seen before. The president alluded to his conspiracy theory that the Obama administration had installed a spy in his campaign activity to ensure Hillary Clinton's victory. In July 2018, he ruminated about a data server allegedly missing from the Democratic National Committee, which he claimed the FBI had failed to enforce. Was that failure a deep state operation, he wondered? Yes, this is the same non-existent server that Ukrainian President Zelensky later requested to obtain in his country as a precondition for U.S. military help being released. He inveighed the deep state in general in September 2018, indicating that he and his allies were offended by his political achievements. He indicated this time that the deep state has its extra-governmental partners, the left and the false news media. The deep state and the left and their tool, the fake news media, are going mad, and they don't know what to do. The economy is booming like never before. Jobs are at record highs. Soon, 2 Supreme Court justices. In other words, President Trump sees the U.S. government as being riddled with unelected, deep-seated political agents who circumvent the electorate to advance their hidden agendas. Those operations, he told a rally in 2018, are just a threat to democracy itself. Does the U.S. have a deep state? U.S. military service chiefs are welcoming Defense Secretary Mark Esper to the Pentagon at a full honor ceremony on July 25, 2019. The November House impeachment hearings gave us testimony from several career diplomats and civil servants, including Marie Yovanovitch, the former Ukrainian ambassador, and Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, a Ukrainian National Security Council specialist. Their appearance prompted John McLaughlin, a former CIA deputy director, to exclaim, "Thank God for the deep state," in a speech at George Mason University. He meant it as a joke, but he also pointed out that its worthwhile testimony could serve as a reminder of the importance of government service. Everybody here has seen this advance of diplomats, and right now intelligence officers and White House troops up to Capitol Hill, he said. Those who have seen the development, he said, have acknowledged that there are people who do their job. McLaughlin told Greg Meyer and Rachel Treisman of National Public Radio that he had received a blowback from his joke, adding, "I think it's a dumb idea. There's no deep state. What people think of as the deep state is just the American civil service, Social Security, the road-fixing people, Medicare, Health and Human Services. I'm going to send one cheer to that sort of deep state. Not a covert, extra-official shadow government, but the actual operation of government itself for the good of the people it's supposed to represent. I am all for people who dedicate their lives to ensuring that our food is as safe as possible, that the cars we drive do not destroy us, that our aircraft stay in the air, and that roads and railways are designed and maintained to connect us. Not to mention clean air and water, public schools and universities to educate our young people, and a social security system to provide us with a safety net. But there's another way of thinking about the deep state, one that indicates a persistent danger to this country and the world, not to Donald Trump and his pals. I am, of course, speaking of the large, albeit informal, diverse, and often internally competitive, conglomerate of industries and branches of government, the makeup of which President Dwight Eisenhower famously called the military-industrial complex. This was precisely the culture that I think President Obama experienced when he wanted to shut down the CIA torture program of the George W. Bush era and realized that the enforcement price was a pledge not to prosecute anybody for crimes committed in the so-called War on Terror. As he famously said, January 2009 was a time to look forward rather than backward. Here's Mike Lofgren, a former civil servant and advisor to several congressional Republicans, writing about the BillMoyers.com national security system in 2014. He defined the power and reach of this system in chilling terms in Anatomy of the Deep State. There's the apparent government around the mall in Washington, and then there's another shadowier, more indefinable government that's not clarified in Civics 101 or seen by the White House or the Capitol to visitors. Indeed, there is another government hidden behind that which is visible at either end of Pennsylvania Avenue, a hybrid body of public and private entities regulating the nation according to predictable trends in season and out, linked to, but only intermittently governed by, the visible state whose leaders we select. Lofgren did not describe a hidden conspiratorial conspiracy. Instead, he argued that the state within a state is mostly hiding in plain sight, and its operators are mostly operating in the light of day. This has been the experience of many who, in particular, have resisted U.S. military actions abroad. They learn that many of the states within a state, lies, deceptions, and crimes, are blatantly there for all to see, and are being perpetrated with absolute impunity at the equivalent of full daylight. This, by the way, poses some apparent difficulties for all of us who condemn Donald Trump's presidency and provocative new militarism, if at least it means supporting such members of the deep state of Lofgren as that old war criminal John Bolton. He has not become a progressive hero only because he has unexpectedly proclaimed himself willing to testify in the impeachment of the Senate if he is summoned. If Bolton decides to do so, you can be sure he won't be guided by a commitment to the rule of law or democratic government. Trump's approach to the deep-seated state of national security was at best ambivalent. It's evident that several of those officials initially thought he could be a target they could aim for and fire at will. But he turned out to be even more insane and volatile than anyone expected. There's evidence, for example, that Trump was confronted with the assassination of Iranian Major General Qasem Soleimani as the most extreme choice possible in an attempt to force him to move against Iran, albeit in a less drastic way. As recently reported by the New York Times, Pentagon officials have frequently given presidents impossible choices to make other possibilities look more palatable. Still, they don't expect presidents to want the decoy. Donald Trump is not one of those presidents. However, there is a way in which the United States under Trump resembles the original Turkish conception of a deep state, the kind of shadow or parallel government structure in which unofficial or publicly unrecognized individuals play important roles in the meaning and execution of state policy. That's a fairly fitting definition of, for example, the behavior of the president's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, about U.S. policy against Ukraine, which he has been organizing for some time and in some way directing. In this case, the only difference is that Trump was stupid enough to accept the position of his lawyer. Might the stupidity drive him out of office one way or the other? Meanwhile, I will continue to send my one cheer to the civil servants who keep the wheels going. However, I think that as the world awaits changes in the Middle East, now that Trump has followed 18 years of U.S. policy and deep state failure with his impetuous interference, few people can give many cheers for the U.S. The deep state, a history. Each presidential government finds some degree of internal resistance. But what the Trump administration has faced appears to be the most violent and hostile ever. From anonymous to a record number of leakers, to the president's physical shielding of information, a large and powerful bureaucratic opposition is at work to hinder many of the priorities of the executive branch. All have been made public, from classified military plans to humiliating facets of White House everyday life. Indeed, the deep state, as the president and his defenders call it, was implacable. Not this is purely partisan either. The same deep state that is dogging Trump has also stopped Obama from closing the Guantanamo Bay, Cuba jail. But whence came the deep American state? Was it still there? The evolution of the deep state, and this choice of word evolution, as opposed to development, will be clarified later, is, some might claim conveniently, contained in a nearly 140-year-old reform anti-corruption measure, one specifically focused on depoliticizing the U.S. government's civilian part. First, let's explain what's called the deep state. It is the non-elected component of the state that is professionalized to the degree that it can be safe in its position and influence independent of political trends. It has the well-earned habit of ignoring political comings and goings, sure of its domain hegemony. It knows the system better than any elected interloper, and it also knows its interests. Even amid the chaos, it persists and flourishes. A natural soil. A minuscule civil service corps was staffed in the decades before the Civil War by what would appear to be entirely tainted by today's standards, the spoils system. Roles were given out to individuals who had actively endorsed candidates or received large campaign contributions that contributed to the success of the newly elected political party. With the party's fall in power, former appointees will leave government jobs and be replaced by the new administration's preferred and esteemed supporters. The federal bureaucracy was strongly, clearly politicized, but it was also small, bore little control, and almost completely overturned every 4 years in any case. The movement came to bring science into many historically autonomous or loosely structured activities with the advent of the revolutionary era, and the spoil system soon came under attack. The Pendleton Civil Service Reform Act, 1883, established a system of merit-based exams and other criteria, as well as a salaried class of government workers. Design flaws. In a large, highly organized organization, especially one in which both long-term service benefits and unusual termination security are present. Incentives to protect the front and center loom status quo. About what we would presume the best intentions of the civil service reform movement were: professionalizing government bureaucracies, eliminating the inefficiencies associated with roles kept for the length of political cycles, and something else. Three weaknesses in policy design will set the stage for the next step of development in the American civil service. One was systemic. Two were mistaken judgments. The conceptual mistake was incorporating a clause into the Pendleton Act that would allow the president to increase the size of civilian government jobs at will. Although in many other accounts, another growth was manipulated in the course of the New Deal or during the Cold War, this one was immediately evident. Indeed, the successor to Arthur, Grover Cleveland, increased the civil service from 16,000 to 27,000. The first of two misjudgments was a failure to understand how the government's size and structure could shift. With more councils, agencies, commissions, committees, and the like, more sensitive military and intelligence roles, and a wide variety of other professional positions, the civilian component's capacity for activism grew proportionately. And where it covered roughly 12% of government workers at the time of the Act's passage, it now covers well over 90%. Furthermore, a large state with a growing number of experts inevitably competes with private interests in the labor market and must therefore, over time, provide wages and benefits which rival those of companies. The reform's architects have failed to realize that out of pure patronage, individuals who are employed are no less likely to have political inclinations than those assigned the same position. And where those holding positions in the spoils system have been washed out of office in 4 years, a group of essentially lifelong bureaucrats facing the prospect of pensions and more powerful positions amid zero democratic oversight is likely to be outwardly demure, though not less militant than their forebears. What happened then? Like every other massive organization, the enormous tower that is the U.S. civil bureaucracy, currently numbered somewhere around 2.85 million people, is subject to both enforced and evolving orders. Executives and managers are specifically allocated, labyrinthine organizational maps, job descriptions, pay scales, areas of responsibility, manuals of all sorts, and every other standardization that informs and impedes the modern workplace. But as the scale of the bureaucracy has swollen, it has also acquired a dissociated but consistent consciousness, a system that is spontaneously organized, unstructured, but without a doubt centered and efficient. Its key roles are to circumvent political initiatives that it collectively finds unpalatable, and to secure the life of the larger body within which it thrives with vigilance. There are no borders and there is no chain of command. For example, it communicates. Leaks recorded in the news give rise to more leaks. Anonymous tips spawn a flood of new tipsters. There is no need for abstract conspiracy theories. A vast army of bureaucrats in an age of free, highly inexpensive burner phones, file-sharing platforms, and document-scanning applications are more than enough to gum up the wheels of executive action. There are no secret codes, no dead drops, and no mysterious agents gathering in parking garages in the dead of night. Even more dauntingly, the deep state coalesces from within a nearly incalculable number of nondescribed men and women with families and homes in Washington, D.C.'s Virginia and Maryland suburbs. His atomic elements, individuals, coach Little League, go to classes at Zumba, and usually have common views. There is no question that many reject the very notion of a deep state. And when they send an anonymous note, shred a document intended for other eyes, or impishly pass a tip onto someone in the media, with a second or third-hand connection, most probably see the deep state as something bigger, above themselves. But the condition is deep. There is another frequently forgotten consequence of the creation of a fixed civil bureaucracy. Awardees of government employment under the spoils system were typically required to donate to their favored party candidates and collect funds for them. By removing what was euphemistically referred to as assessments, essentially fees and contributions paid by individuals on request or wished while virtual. Instead of paying for favors, after that political access and power are guided, and overwhelmingly, by wealthy individuals, interest groups, and large corporations. Lingering concerns. Two bigger problems are pending. Much of the world around us, and maybe much of it, is influenced not by expert planning, but by the unforeseen effects of their plans. And from the beginning, these side effects aren't immediate obvious. Others can take decades to materialize. Others emerge not only as byproducts of a given program, but when they communicate with other initiatives or their byproducts. Recognizing the uncertainty can balance not only planners' ambition, but the courtesy and acuteness engaged in watching over them. Second, the political debate usually revolves around solutions. Tidy, distinct remedies which, as imagined, solve problems quickly and seamlessly. The wider variety of incomplete solutions that present trade-offs in the short or long term are less commonly discussed, but can include fewer surprises in the longer term. Several of the trade-offs are readily obvious. Others have not existed for years. The pre-Pendleton Act period's corruption appeared unacceptable enough for almost every substitute to be superior. Better yet, technology and merit should be utilized in a successor scheme. A bigger question is whether the deep state is an option or an error, even as an unintended consequence of the Pendleton Act. Do unselected government workers play a critical role, even in nominal democracy, in restoring equilibrium, or do they represent an insidious, potentially worrisome repository of unintended power? By the 1870s, the notion that the federal bureaucracy was dominated by the preferred or highest-paying individuals was strikingly distasteful to the public. It seemed like a simpler, tidier approach to replace it with a merit scheme. It undoubtedly appealed to the growing demand for scientific solutions that dominated the American policy environment between the 1880s and the end of World War I. But practically no one could have predicted the massive increase in the size of the U.S. government over the next 140 years and the subsequent explosion in the size of the civil service. Connect to the legislative expansion by authorizing the president to broaden the ranks of covered government employees at will, and we face the present. Americans have had the peculiar feeling for a long time that elections don't matter about as much as the current media hoopla would suggest. It's real, and one reason that's all about structural improvements in how we employ and fire inside the federal bureaucracy by constructing a shield on democracy itself, the rise of the deep state, at the expense of a less adaptable system, and increasing public cynicism about who is really in charge. Okay, Wednesday, October 7th, 12:30, 2 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. It's currently 71 degrees, cloudy skies. Chapter 6, The Deep State and America. Peter Dale Scott's participation in anti-war activism provided the first spark for his scholarship as a literature professor at the University of California at Berkeley. His advocacy culminated in 1972, when his first book, The War Plan, was published, alleging that the U.S. intelligence community had helped push Washington to interfere in Vietnam. His continued interest in the history of the war quickly sparked greater interest in the assassination of Kennedy, a moment many activists highlighted as a turning point in America's participation in Southeast Asia. Scott kept publishing during his research on Kennedy, releasing an edited volume on Iran-Contra and the role cocaine smugglers played in the scandal. By the time the University of California Press published Deep Politics and JFK's Death, Oliver Stone's cinematic portrayal of the assassination had come and gone to theaters, sparking a groundswell of concern. Unlike most of the works on the topic, however, Deep Politics spends no energy contesting what is exposed in the Zapruder film or discussing the merits of the magic bullet theory. The assassination, as Scott would have it, opened windows to several topics that were otherwise concealed from the view of the public. The Warren Commission, as well as the re-examination of the inquiry by Congress in 1976, provided a treasure trove of insights into the relationship between the CIA and organized crime and its monitoring operations within the United States. In researching the biographies and incidents connected with the shooting, Scott points to a multitude of movements trying to change Kennedy's policies, intensify the Cold War, and further causes of the right wing. Although stressing the importance of the hidden forces that possibly gained from the assassination, Deep Politics does not provide a clear alternative version of what happened in Dealey Plaza at any stage. "You cannot solve the case," Scott said in a 2007 interview to me. "But by researching the case, we can learn a lot more about America." Instead of throwing off Oswald and unmasking the real killers of JFK, Deep Politics draws from the assassination a much wider historical lesson. In Scott's opinion, Kennedy's death wasn't a random external plot that hit the U.S. It was more likely to reflect a systemic change intended to circumvent Kennedy's tendencies toward domestic political reform and military de-escalation abroad. While not identifying the plot, Scott hypothesizes that a great alliance of powers contained inside public government, organized crime, and private money orchestrated and took advantage of the death of the president. Deep Politics muses that the killing of JFK was only one episode within a series of cases that contributed to the continuation of the Cold War and the protection of unliberal policies at home, cases that may have included Watergate and Iran-Contra. But for whatever parapolitics or deep politics residing behind the Kennedy assassination and other contentious events, Scott provides no conclusive ruling as to what this parallel source of authority should be called. His involvement in the 2006 Melbourne conference finally gave him a more suitable diction for what he was trying to explain in deep politics. While he had attended the event to discuss his work on drug trafficking and politics in Mexico, he found a novel structure in Ola Tunander's paper, which could be applied to a new research project that he had initiated. In The Path to 9/11, Power, Hegemony, and America's Future, Scott identifies the deep-seated American state as the potentially complicit author and direct beneficiary of the 2001 attack. He does not provide an alternate explanation for what occurred on 9/11 as in deep politics, although he supports the work of David Ray Griffin and others who argue that the attacks were the result of a conspiracy beyond Al-Qaeda. Instead, he spends a lot of the book charting the past of clandestine U.S. interference abroad and how such policies helped bring Osama bin Laden into being. For Scott, the covert players who helped lay Al-Qaeda's foundations were the same as those who have helped push and manipulate U.S. foreign policy since the Cold War. Specifically, elements of the U.S. intelligence community, oil industry, and organized crime. The reaction from Washington to 9/11 was also the result of the historical growth of the deep state. In discussing the roots of the Patriot Act and Guantanamo, Scott claims that the Bush administration representatives, primarily Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, supported similar policies from the 1970s. Among the more surprising arguments of the path to 9/11 is the belief that Cheney and Rumsfeld had helped form Reagan's government continuity strategy, which called for the suspension of the Constitution and the establishment of internment camps run by FEMA in the event of a national crisis. Elements of this initiative were implemented, Scott hypothesizes, on or after 9/11. As with Deep Politics, The Path to 9/11 was published by the University of California Press as a peer-reviewed monograph. Both works have high footnotes. While some government documents provide the basis for his facts, Scott relies primarily on the reporting of investigative journalists and other outlets of the press as the key base for his research. To date, few scholarly journals have published book reviews. Ola Tunander gave the most glowing assessment of the work among the few that exist. The ambivalent reception of the book by academics did nothing to contradict the presentation of the book elsewhere. Scott first appeared on Alex Jones's radio show, InfoWars, in February 2008. Alex Jones had only just begun to become a global sensation by then. Jones's argument that the 9/11 attacks were an inside job had already given rise to a truther movement aimed at revealing the involvement of the CIA, Mossad, and foreign industrialists, mainly those connected to the Bilderberg Group, in the attack. Scott's results instantly correlated with this line of thought. He subsequently made live appearances on InfoWars and published articles on the website of the channel. Other contributors to the brand of Alex Jones soon started incorporating the deep state into their study of the Obama administration and the U.S. government as a whole. By 2016, InfoWars prophesied that Donald Trump was the man most likely to destroy the deep state, which one author likened to a satanic coalition made up of capitalists, corporatists, and representatives of the military-industrial complex of America. The deep state did not become a staple for the news site of Steve Bannon, Breitbart, until 1 month after Election Day. In a lengthy survey detailing what the author suggested will be a forthcoming battle between the deep state versus Donald Trump, an anonymous writer, Virgil, who some commentators believe to be Bannon, described the deep American state as a vast informal government containing untold thousands of bureaucrats, technocrats, and plutocrats dedicated to keeping President-elect Trump out of power. It spreads through the entire federal government, indeed the whole world, cautioned Virgil. And it contains not just the politicians, but also a multitude of the alleged private sector companies, profiteers, and others. It can be noted that within the American context, scholars other than Peter Dale Scott had toiled with ideas close to the deep state. As early as 2014, Tufts University professor Michael Glennon gave the phrase double government in describing the residual structures of national security that spanned the Bush and Obama administrations. The continuities between Bush and Obama, he claimed, showed that the country had moved beyond a mere imperial presidency to a bifurcated regime, a dual government framework, under which even the president now retains no substantive influence over the overall course of U.S. national security policy. And he does not at any time portray the double government of America as wedded to the mafia or multinational corporations. Nor does he take incidents such as the JFK assassination as evidence of the presence of the dual government. At this point, double government isn't likely to invoke the same strength and sense as the deep state. As the principal term synonymous with alternative outlets of influence or covert politics, the deep state has been deeply embedded within America's political language since the spring of 2017. Since then, attempts to describe its content have ranged from genuinely committed attempts to acts of absolute mockery. The phrase has taken on a highly political connotation within the United States over the last year. At least four of the most prominent supporters of President Trump have written book-length accounts of the fight for the deep state to overthrow his administration. In the meantime, Scott has continued to write and give interviews on the subject, recently stating that he hopes Trump and the deep state can make the other more moderate. Back to look ahead. If something has been accomplished in the debates since February 2017, it is to underline the contradictions which have long beset the rhetorical part of the deep state. Although it was first invented over 20 years ago, it has not completely taken hold of any clear meaning of what that means. Using the term commonly denotes confidence in an informal or parallel government that has official, normally more representative, institutions to combat. Who forms this shadow government is entirely dependent on who you ask, and when, or when the conversation is going on. Although the word originated regarding control security agencies has on state and society, such as in Turkey, The list of deep state actors includes social groups suspected of manipulating ordinary people, such as the mafia, big business, or ideological extremists. Extreme political developments were typically the catalysts for those who find the word appropriate or helpful, up until February 2017. In other words, for those who doubt the true roots of any number of unusual, typically violent events, it's the deep state has served as a brief answer. So Cerulic, the JFK assassination, 9/11, etc. What is surprising about the coming of the deep state to America is that it was used so preemptively. The American deep state matters for pundits who now use the word literally, since it is capable of, or expected to, unseat President Donald Trump, and not simply because of what it has done before. It remains to be seen if academics will continue engaging in discussion about the deep state. Most reputable scholars would probably think twice before attempting to distill or prove the existence of a deep state, given the divisive political radioactivity that has enveloped the term. What also seems to suggest the historical history of the concept is to the extent the search for shadow regimes has always been elusive. Certainly, several historical instances seem to suggest covert agendas and hidden cabals within governments. It is not only wild-eyed hysteria or political motives that motivate attempts to record and contextualize such conspiracies. In the U.S. case, corruption allegations inside the government have caused major public disclosures. For example, widespread skepticism about the JFK assassination prompted Congress to launch a new investigation, leading to surprising official revelations about the CIA's domestic surveillance activities and attempts to hire American mafia elements. Whether such leaks are indicative of ongoing political cabals or shadow regimes is always a problem where deep state discussions become controversial. Proposing that a deep institutional state exists suggests that, through the passing of years and shifts in staff and systems, several individuals and organizations collaborate, harmoniously or otherwise. Making such an argument becomes much more fraught when one extends the scope of deep state players to include broad categories such as the government, organized crime, or big oil. One point to say is that bureaucracies may resist reform or assume that private people or organizations may secretly manipulate legislators. The belief that such interests form distinct collectives that can span decades or centuries without changing or breaking down is yet another. Assuming that a deep state is a permanent presence within states may lead one to construe it as an actual entity with a constant cast of persons meeting and planning over long periods. At best, the prospects for demonstrating the presence of such a parallel state, in the form of government papers or independent testimony, are questionable. More often than not, those trying to conflate and marginalize political critics and adversaries are granted a license to look for a deep state. One lesson to be gleaned from the deep state's conceptual growth concerns the accountability issue. At the heart of the rhetorical appeal of the deep state lies a mistrust of government, especially governments or parts of it, which are assumed to be less than forthcoming. The clandestine or closed existence of many organizations that are routinely associated with the idea, such as military and intelligence services, will readily intensify concerns regarding deeper conspiracies. One way to rectify the cause of such concerns is to ensure that state records are open to the public and conducted consistently and clearly. In the case of the United States, mandating the publication after normal periods of all state documents is one potential remedy, as seen in Britain's 20-year rule. Such a system will alleviate most of the paperwork, cost, and frustration that plagues researchers and archivists using College Park, Maryland's National Archive. But the probability that Washington's lawmakers will be comfortable allowing greater access to state documents is certainly slim. The declassification of current and historical records remains incomplete, pending changes under the Obama administration. In addition to official apprehensions regarding the publication of previously kept secrets, Congress has repeatedly cut the National Archives budget. Between 2008 and 2018, the archives' operating expenses fell 8%. Any increase in the budget of the archive, not to mention an increase of public access, will be a subtle but important step towards restoring public confidence in state institutions and helping to counteract the mistrust that undergirds the deep state. Manuscript Division, Congress Library. A scrap of paper from March 1791 in the Library of Congress indicates the plan's earliest appearance. Thomas Jefferson illustrated a master vision with a few simple strokes of his pen. The single word "president" above the White House's future site, and another word "capital" to the east. There will be public walks in between, which was a clear definition of the mall to come. When he dreamed of the future, Jefferson was channeling the ancients. He sketched the term Tiber after the river of Rome over a small stream. A nearby elevation called Jenkins Hill was soon to be renamed Capitol Hill after the Capitoline of Rome. Eventually, intricate street plans will be mapped over a landscape that still housed more bears than humans, with parks, grids, and slashing diagonals like those of Versailles. Progress came slowly because the land at issue declined to cooperate. Pierre Charles L'Enfant, the genius French draftsman, employed to hammer out the details, complained that the land was swampy. There are signs of the trouble to come in Jefferson's sketch. Low soundings for the shallow Potomac and a mud river not far from the federal city. The water was always brackish. A few years earlier, in 1785, George Washington wrote a letter praising the Potomac specifically for this reason. "The Potomac bed in front of my house contains an inexhaustible manure fund." That was good for farmers, but less so for government workers. Why did the founders select their capital for such a remote place? There was a bit of a swamp, too. New York was the seat of government when George Washington was inaugurated in April 1789, the latest in a long list of locations where Congress had gathered, including Philadelphia, Lancaster, York, Baltimore, Annapolis, Trenton, and Princeton. But the problem was festering, and so many ideas were still coming in for the Capitol's northern and southern iterations that one satirist suggested a mobile platform with a few buildings and a George Washington statue that could be wheeled from one place to another. In the spring of 1790, Congress, already fragmented, clashed for everything, and its permanent position and willingness to pay for itself were high on the list of disputes. The two issues were finally merged into a masterly arrangement, reached about June 20th by Jefferson, Madison, and Hamilton. They met at Jefferson's New York home at 57 Maiden Lane, the room where it happened, known to any Hamilton fan, to hash out the specifics in what might have been the most important dinner in American history. The deal was on the table. Congress will agree to assume the state's debt burden, facilitating the development of a strong economy that will soon be based in nearby Wall Street. In return, Hamilton will agree to back up the idea of a capital closer to home in the South. Manuscript Division, Library of Congress. Jefferson seemed to regret the arrangement. He admitted to George Washington that it was the worst political error of his life, because a revitalized economy had given rise to a speculative phalanx that had exposed very early the dispiriting power of money in our politics. But even Northerners would challenge a deal that now forced them to travel a great distance, along terrible roads, to a city that seemed to settle into the ooze on which it was founded. As it turned out, the speculative phalanx was still involved in the South, where investors had purchased land around Washington's future site a long time ago. A low-grade Potomac fever had raced through these investors' bloodstream as they were chasing a dream of luring settlers to the enchanted spot. They pictured a great industrial city emerging from the river's manure-rich banks. Unfortunately, the Potomac is one of the most frustrating rivers in North America from a hard-nosed business point of view, promising plenty but offering absolutely nothing. It starts in the Virginia and West Virginia mountains, and its waterfalls obstruct navigation. To travel upriver to Cumberland and Harper's Ferry, 17 miles of the portage was required. The river is too small for large vessels for most of the year. Despite attempts to dredge deeper channels, it is relatively shallow to this day. Especially one disappointment stung. The new location's supporters strongly proposed a distant link to the Ohio River, North America's great natural conduit upstream, and eventually to the Mississippi and Mexico's Gulf. If it were real, it would have been fantastic. Virginian proponents had planned such a connection for decades, and explorers explored the western Virginia and Pennsylvania forests to show that there was a simpler way to get to Ohio than there was. Jefferson wrote to Washington, "Nature then proclaimed in support of the Potomac, and through that medium offers the entire Western world trade to spill into our lap." It was a typical Jeffersonian thought, eloquent, optimistic, and insistent, that it was self-evident that a truth hoped for was. But in the end, the relation did not exist despite all the promises, as Thomas Jefferson knew very well. His father, Peter Jefferson, had surveyed the Potomac to its disappointing sources. Washington was built on a hyperbole basis a mud bank similar to the one Jefferson sketched in his map. There was one industry in which the new city would thrive, which in no way required ships, portages, or a lot of labor. In the critical years of 1789 and 1790, an intensive lobbying campaign was initiated by investors in the future site, claiming that the city would soon be larger than London, that children would regard it with rapture, and that it would be the only imperial city ever built on the universal and everlasting principles of freedom and reason. So it happened. Loosened by the dinner contract and the extraordinary reputation of the person whose name would bear the new town, Washington may be the only city on earth to have lobbied itself into being. Chapter 7. How the Deep Came to America. A History. It's been almost 2 years since the Deep State became a part of the American lexicon. It was at the beginning of February 2017, only weeks after President Donald Trump's inauguration, when news outlets first reported the growing use of the term within the inner circle of the president. In the months that followed, the president and his administration's allies openly embellished on the sense and importance of the deep state, rendering it a catchphrase for alleged internal enemies inside Washington. News analysis of the phenomenon has done much to shed light on how the ideology of far right-wing activists such as Steve Bannon and Alex Jones has helped to bring administration supporters to the idea of deep state. While the phrase has generated a great deal of attention in the national media, it is now apparent that the notion of the deep state has gained some significance for the U.S. public. A total of 37% of respondents had heard of a thing called the deep state, according to a spring 2018 Monmouth poll. When asked whether they believed there was a network of non-elected government and military officers secretly controlling or directing national politics, nearly three-quarters of respondents agreed there was a deep state. For some time now, the idea of the deep state has been a matter of concern to me. As a Republic of Turkey historian, I was first introduced to the word as a graduate student almost 20 years ago. When I started visiting Turkey for the first time in the early 2000s, someone who talked about the deep state did not do so facetiously or objectively. Not only did serious people acknowledge the presence of a Turkish deep state, but they also appeared to believe it constituted a significant factor that characterized the history of Turkey. Most of my research has been devoted, for more than a decade, to understanding many of the people, organizations, and events connected with the deep Turkish state. Books and articles written by a Canadian diplomat turned professor named Peter Dale Scott were among the works which inspired me to look more closely at the deep state phenomenon in Turkey. His novel, published in 1993 by the University of California Press, Deep Politics and JFK's Death, caught my attention as one of the few scholarly studies to frame American history in a light close to Turkish deep state discussions. In 2007, I had the opportunity to interview Scott on a thankfully short-lived podcast that I had released at Long Island University while a lecturer. Our conversation took place within weeks of the publication of his newest book, The Road to 9/11, in which he, for the first time, used the word deep state. It was as a result of this book and the attention it subsequently gained from Alex Jones and others that many Americans first entertained the notion of a deep state lording over the U.S. The capital grew out of these muddy banks, and sometimes it lived up to its billing. The capital was beautiful, as was the White House. As a permanent population began to settle there, Washington acquired some of the characteristics of a city. Newspapers, banks, and a thriving hospitality industry specializing in offering temporary shelter to lawmaking. But over time, it became evident that the brackishness of the new town was a problem. To put it simply, the Potomac had too little water and too much of it on land. Congressmen hated having to tiptoe through what they called the Pennsylvania Avenue swamps to get to the White House. The avenue has been dubbed the Great Serb Bog. Periodic attempts to construct canals around the waterfalls brought slow-moving, stagnant, odorous waters that appeared to symbolize government inertia. The city that lacked a navigable river also suffered from another problem, fetid creeks that carried raw sewage to and from its numerous population centers, which were far from each other. Early visitors called it, facetiously, the City of Magnificent Distances. In 1789, a Massachusetts congressman, Theodore Sedgwick, wrote, "The Potomac's atmosphere is not only unhealthy but harmful to northern constitutions. The district's smells added fuel to an increasing resentment of a city that offended northerners for its adherence to slavery and inaccessibility. Washington was a spiritual trap to an abolitionist like William Lloyd Garrison. The city is rotten with the plague and stinks in the world's nostrils. There is scarcely a fouler place on earth." An eyewitness in 1860 cast an eye on the canals of the city and glimpsed dead cats and all kinds of putridity in a stagnant pool rink of pestilential odors. Fortunately, when nature refused to cooperate, the capital could still rely on its intellect for self-promotion. When General Lafayette visited in 1824 by delivering a splendid soundbite, he happily complied with local tradition. He referred to the small, muddy town as the central star of the constellation that illuminates the whole world. The capital has filled itself in with time. The Magnificent Distances, as tens of thousands migrated there during the Civil War and its aftermath, started to make more sense. The legacies of that war included a town that had become a true national capital, backed by a greatly expanded government and military. Via land reclamation projects and other public works that took greater advantage of the Potomac and its tributaries, Washingtonians shored up their infrastructure over the next century. The river would never become a major commercial artery. Still, it was all the same beautiful, and by diverting water into new channels, architects were able to create the views that we know and love so well, like the reflecting pool in front of the Lincoln Memorial and the Jefferson Memorial tidal basin. What follows is not so much an attempt to address or describe the nature of the deep state, but to trace the history of how and why the word came into American speaking. It is a tale that starts first in Turkey, where the word was first coined, and built on how it has been used elsewhere by scholars and commenters. How Peter Dale Scott learned of the concept and came to apply it to the U.S. is instructive about the ideas and pitfalls that have long characterized the concept's growth. Within government conspiracies or the suggestion of deception can be found in most countries' annals, including the United States. Revelations about these schemes have always led observers to believe that the hidden cabals are central to the politics of a country, creating structures for themselves. Aspects of Turkish culture, as well as cases elsewhere, indicate such a phenomenon is not the product of imagination entirely. Yet it is another matter to describe what precisely constitutes a deep state, let alone to chart its existence. The tale